Hello. It's almost time for What Were They Made, but it's currently November, which is a good chance to do something good through the means of Movember, which for me currently consists of sporting a pretty embarrassing mustache. Got rid of the facial hair I did have. Now I have a little bit of facial hair, and I do not suit a mustache.
It's coming in all right. We'll see how it is.
Been a few days. Yeah. I only shaved a few days ago. I didn't shave on the 1st of November, so I can feel the kind of stubble. It's odd having to shave all the time, but it is for a good cause. Movember is in support of the prevention of the death of young men, whether that's through the mental health crisis of suicide, whether that's through prostate cancer or testicular cancer. It's raising awareness and money for people who really are in need of that. So I'm raising money for that. What we'll be doing is popping a link in the description of this episode. I'm aiming for a raising of £100, and if I hit that goal, I'll show you all this ridiculous excuse for a mustache come the end of November. And also committed to, should we hit £1,000?
Okay, you're doing this.
I'll even get a What Were They Made tattoo, something of some description, something silly probably, but I'll do that, and I'm terrified of tattoos. But it's an important cause. It's one that I value. It's close to my heart. And if you have a friend or anyone you know who you haven't talked to in a while, or someone you feel needs a talking to, have that conversation. Look after your own health. Look after your friend's health.
Reach out. Talk to people.
Doesn't matter how it is. Whatever you say, whatever you do, even if it's playing a very long board game for a very long time, it doesn't matter how you hang out or how you look out for another person. It's just important that you do. But that's enough of the important stuff. Let's get on to the less important, nonsensical stuff. Let's do some War With A Mate. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to War With A Mate, with me, James.
Me, Andy.
And some turbulent weather.
But we'll get to it.
Oh, all that and more to come, because we've wrapped up turn two. It's over, the second turn. We've done two of these now.
Yeah.
That's, how far does that put us into the game?
A third.
A third of the whole game.
No.
Oh, of course, this is the practice run.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know, I'm sorry you're here, first of all. This is going to get really, really bogged down very quickly. We recommend going back and figuring out what's going on here, because we are playing a board game for a very long time. It's SPIs, the Campaign for North Africa. It's never been finished before, but we're going to do our best to finish it. The only thing that will stop us is an untimely demise or nuclear winter. And we don't
what
think
the chances are either them.
We don't think we'll have an early demise. I think me and you would survive an early winter. An early winter. Yeah, an early winter's not going to roll around.
No.
If anything, an early winter's been put off by global warming.
That's what you love to hear.
We're in a good spot right now. So, yeah, we're continuing to play the game. We're in a practice run of six turns. We haven't even touched the main game. But two turns down, Andy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
We wrapped up the trucking convoy to end hop stage three.
It's truck day.
It's a truck day.
And I don't mind truck day anymore, Andy.
I don't like that because my truck day's always been fairly fine because I've just got a line of supply to handle. Watching you over this turn get a grip on supply and then also discover you've got several divisions you forgot about really has put me on the back foot.
Turn two has been my real renaissance.
Yes.
I've come into my own in turn two. I feel like I really have got to grips with some of the most important aspects of the game, such as how many men do I have and where do my trucks go? It's been a real nightmare before now, but this felt so easy. I guess, where do you want to start?
I guess I had initiative, so my trucking was fairly simple. I did a little loop near Mersa Matru for my guys there, and then otherwise it was two convoys shuttling back and forth from Alexandria. Very simple truck stage for me. And then also I used the Commonwealth Rail to whip 1,500 tons of stuff up to Mesa Matru, which was mainly ammo.
Yeah, you've got... How much does it you move? A ton and a half?
1,500
1,500 tons. No, yes. That's right. Yeah, a ton and a half is not impressive at all.
No.
Yeah, because I think ammo is 4 tons.
Yeah, it is.
1 unit of ammo. So you ship that along.
And I also realized a mistake I'd been making for, I guess, every truck convoy stage up to now.
Which is 6 of them.
Yes. Which is, I had been trucking water up to Mesa Matru, but it has a water pipeline. So those trucks could have had anything but water.
And it's a settlement. So yes. it has unlimited water. Well, not unlimited, but it has a well.
Yes.
So it has a very decent supply of water at all times.
So I've wasted a lot of tonnage miles.
Yeah, I guess it'd be interesting to convert that, see how much movement you've wasted shipping around water that doesn't need to be shipped.
Yeah, it's probably quite a bit.
That reminds me,
because when I started, I was doing, and this is really a bad move, just a quarter of each.
Oh, yeah.
Hadn't worked out. I was just about to say that. Expenditure rates. Yeah. So the first turn of trucking was really a disaster.
Yeah, I was splitting my trucks equal, and turns out you don't need to do that.
You need very little water and fuel relative, I reckon.
I found that out today when I was doing my supplies.
Yeah.
I moved so few trucks full of water compared to everything else.
Yeah.
But we moved our trucks around. You moved yours to where they needed to go, which is, yeah, like you say, a straight line. You kind of just zipped them along between Cairo Alexandria and Mesa Matru. And there's a few roads that are destroyed there, so you did have to roll some breakdown.
It's starting to get there.
And
I lost 25% of one of my convoys.
Which I'm more than happy with. All those bombing runs have finally paid off. Like a quarter of your trucks in that run broke down.
It was quite a big convoy as well. Luckily, it broke down at Mesa Matru.
Yeah,
so,
I hate that. I hate that
it
broke down.
That is a repair facility, so...
Yeah.
I'll roll them at the start of next session, the repairs for there.
Yeah, I don't like that they broke down right where they get fixed.
Yeah. Because I had a little bit left to do to get... Because we've got store expenditure coming up, so I had a couple units to get just topped up so that they're not going to go hungry.
Yes. I encountered that issue because my movement of my trucks was centered around not necessarily getting the trucks to Men, but getting the food to supply dumps near Men. I moved a lot of trucks from Bardia more than once to get to the supply dump I've got next to my northern wall, as I called it.
Yeah.
So that's the group of guys up along the northern road. I've got 4 or 5 divisions that are floating around that area. And I managed to move 2 different convoys twice to that supply dump. So quick trip once with a supply run that I've had available for a good while. It's a fairly small convoy. It's one of my legacy convoys.
Yeah.
And then one of my big convoys that came along from Tripoli, maybe start of this turn or the turn, maybe upstage 3 of turn 1. It was a while ago now.
Yeah.
But they are bigger than all my other convoys. They are 30 plus trucks. So moving them in and out twice. My stores and ammo, my water and fuel, I've got everything I really need for the foreseeable. And it's crazy because that's the first time I've made a real dent in Bardia's supplies, because they've been shipped supplies twice by the Axis naval convoy.
Yeah. Did they get 1,000 tons?
What, the Axis naval convoy?
The Bardia one.
The Bardia one is... No, it's. I think it's more than that because it's... it's a major city, I think, or a major settlement.
Yeah, I just know, because Tobruk's bigger.
Tobruk is quite a lot bigger.
And then Tripoli's unlimited, and then Bardia.
Bardia's the smallest of the 3.
Smallest of them, but still.
But I've barely dented their supplies previously, because the stuff I've had consuming it has just been the garrison there, and then a few units that have popped in for a quick stop-off, just usually on the road to go fight you. So they've not really had their stores drained at any point apart from the garrison. Their ammo has taken like a few licks, but I've never really had the trucks attached to units to take much away from there. So it's really just been what's been eaten up while they're actually there.
Yeah.
So now I've taken a good chunk of that, put it in my supply dump 1, and now I've got a nice forward operating base for this northern wall push. Aside from that, I resupplied my airfields again. I've now got a bit of a pendulum, a convoy that's moving between Tobruk and the airfields on map B, which are all sort of coastal based.
Yep.
So I dropped off to as many of them as I could. There's still a few I need to resupply next truck convoy stage. I just ran out of CPA because it's two to drop off.
Yes.
And I just didn't have it to do them all. And I thought that'll be great because next airfield stage, I can use all these newly supplied airfields. That'll be great. That'll be great. I also moved, and this is a big one, I moved hundreds of trucks to Nephilia.
Yes, so they just came out your Tripoli boxes to the far western point of the map, but yes, they're on the map now.
They could have been there much earlier, but I've had them following alongside the black shirts in case I need to motorize them.
Yep.
And now I'm at the decision point where I need to actually choose if I'm motorizing the black shirts or if I'm sending off hundreds of trucks to become new convoys.
Yeah, because they're full at the moment, aren't
they? They are full. They're full of supplies. Went back over, had a look at that. They are full of supplies.
Will they still be quartered?
They are. They're quarter supplied.
Yeah,
so a quarter of them have water, fuel, ammo, and stores. So they're not optimized, but with the sheer number of them, it's just shock and awe. I can just send them along. They can refuel, restock anything that they come across. So I now need to decide how many men are going in these trucks and how many of these trucks are going to become a big distribution network of, yeah, massive convoys. I've already broken them down in my head, the four convoys I want. It's just a case of how big do I want them, and do I want splinter convoys kind of similar to what I had before, but now with an actual organization?
Yeah.
I'd essentially have first, second, third, and fourth line trucks the way this would work.
Would the fourth lines be bringing it from Tripoli, basically?
The fourth lines would be going to the splinter areas. They'd essentially have a two upstage lead time where they'd be going to further afield airstrips or some of the garrisons. But the issue is, do I really need them in this scenario?
Yeah.
So I'm weighing it up.
I guess, the fact we're finishing in six turns versus this being the start of 111.
Yeah.
You've got different considerations.
Exactly. But part of me wants to maybe try it just for experience. So I'd be kind of sacrificing resources. It's kind of metagaming in a way where I'm getting a feel for how the full game would go by practicing with these ones. But at the same time, it's kind of viable in the game itself anyway, because that way I'm not letting my unit starve. So it feels justified.
Yes, you have both going for you.
So, I'm weighing that up, but I think it's definitely possible that I'll splinter them off. I don't think both of these black shirt divisions are getting motorized. I think one will at most.
Yeah.
But, excuse me. I've got a bad cough. I've been drinking Cavonia all day, because I've had a bad throat for a while.
Not a drink.
It's not a drink. When I say drinking all day, I've not been pouring glasses of it. I've been having the recommended dosage, but I just have to psych myself up for it because it's so horrible. I can't drink licorice, aniseed sort of things. When I was like 17, I went to I went out with someone we used to hang out with a while ago.
Oh yeah, that guy.
What I'll say is denim suit. And you probably know who I mean immediately.
I knew who you meant before.
And I had 17 shots of Sambuca in one night.
I mean, that's just such a dumb idea.
I was a kid. I was a teenager. I did that, and then I was sick. Next to a bouncer. The bouncer got rid of me from the place I was trying to get into. Underage. I was sick in the taxi on the way home to my mother's. And then I was sick at my part-time job the next day. And it stunk of licorice and aniseed. It stunk of Sambuca. And I told him I had food poisoning. And looking
you must
back,
have stunk like a sort of 1800s pharmacy. Just booze and aniseed. And like, they knew what was up.
Looking back, I'm like, I thought I really finessed that situation, where I was like, oh yeah, I've pulled this off. But in hindsight, they did call my mother because she...
That is, if someone ever calls you a mother in a professional environment, you've gone beyond.
There's a reason.
That's such failure.
I was working at the same place she used to work.
Okay.
So she knew everyone there. That's why. They didn't just call my next of kin, which, you know, it didn't get that bad. But yeah, I've been drinking this Cavonia shit all day. It's cough medicine with clout, and they mean that. I feel like there is really some bull in that, some bullshit.
Well, you know it works because it's horrible.
No, I don't know that. I think that's, they make it taste
medicine
horrible.
Medicine shouldn't be nice.
No, no. Maybe if we're going back to the days of yore where it's, you know, it is aniseed-y, but not anymore. Anyway, I feel like I've been back on the 17-year-old drink. but anyway, went off point. I've got my voice back, so we're all good. I think now that I've got this idea of how my truck should work, I feel a lot more confident going into the main game. I just need to have more instances of practice in that. I'm interested to see if this truck thing does actually work for this scenario, for the rest of it. I've started to repair stuff, which was a big thing.
Yep.
We had the repair segment, and for the first time we've rolled repair rolls, not just to move stuff, but to actually repair things in the facility. I got one heavy truck, I got five medium trucks, one heavy truck.
Yeah, you just said that.
One light, sorry. I'm going, in my head, I was going both sides. I've got one light, one heavy,
right.
Five medium, and I've got...
Do you get a tank back as well?
I've got four or five tanks, CV-33s.
Yeah.
I think it's four. So I got some of those back as well, which is good. That's all good stuff. So I've got some repaired stuff. I'm ready to move them out. I need to now start looking at replacement point rules because we've not actually employed those properly yet.
No.
So I need to see how these tanks work. The trucks I'm hoping to use as part of this new distribution network, but I can't guarantee that because, again, my network's kind of up in the air, but they will be doing something good. All in all, I think the trucks went fairly well. I'm happy with the repairs. And after that, all that was left to do was have a look at initiative and weather.
Yep, I have initiative again.
Once again, Andy has initiative, which is game-changing. And who did you pick to go first in the next op stage, Andy?
Drumroll, please.
It's you. It was you. It was always going to be you. That's not fuck around. That's not bait people. No cliffhangers. You picked you. You were always going to pick you.
Correct.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And then we had a little weather forecast.
We did, and it's bad.
My rain
James.
Dance worked.
Your rain dance.
It's a rainstorm.
It's rain on two map tiles.
Yes, B and C, otherwise known as your map tiles.
So that whole push that I made, as all of you will probably recall, when I drove Andy out of map C almost entirely, apart from the 7th, and his truck bandits on B, I've now been hit. Karma has come round. I don't know why karma would ever hit me in this situation, apart from maybe the people I'm playing as. But my central ground that I'm now holding is being hit by a rainfall, and so is map B, which is my sort of semi-forward operating base. I'll tell you what it is, Andy.
It's your airfield.
It's where all of my airfields are that have just been resupplied. And planes can't fly in rainstorms, so I can't use any of those planes I've just resupplied.
Fantastic.
So that thing I was saying there about getting my trucks round and resupplying the rest of the airfields, I guess that will happen. They will be fully stocked by the time I get to fly these planes.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it's nice for me. It'll be bad for you. But you don't care about that because you have an air plan.
Well...
No, you bastard. Don't you giggle at me. Don't you giggle at me.
Well, I can't fly into maps B and C. And I'd have to fly through them to get to A, which leaves your one unit on map D, the Saharan detachment.
Yes.
So the air phase that's coming up, they are going to face the entire RAF in North Africa.
You are localizing the Blitz.
Yes.
On one detachment.
Yeah. And they... I got 30 bombers in upstage one of turn three.
Do you really? Well, yeah. they would have to be flown on a transfer mission first, though, so...
No, they arrive at Cairo Alexandria.
Oh, what? No.
Where would they transfer in from?
Oh, I don't know. Britain?
Nah, that's not how they did it.
Right, okay. I just thought, because I've got all this off-map shit. I've got Tripoli, and I've got Tripolitania, and everywhere else. I've got to fly all my stuff. I thought Malta, maybe, like...
I could have dropped them off at Malta, but...
But you didn't.
But why?
I don't know, to be nice.
I actually have a bold plan for Malta next turn.
Do you really?
Yes.
Right, well, I don't have a... I forgot about Malta, to be honest. At the start of the game, Malta felt so important. And it turns out Malta doesn't come up all that much.
Yeah, well, once a turn, I bombed one convoy for like 10%, and then the other time I just didn't find anything.
That's a good point. Maybe Malta's bigged up too much. Maybe we were wrong. History's wrong. And Malta wasn't a vital part of this.
I think it will be.
I don't know that. I've not seen the proof. You know, I also thought the long-range desert group would be some sort of formidable force.
They've done nothing.
They've drove around a lot.
Oh, yeah.
They're like the hairy bikers.
They've covered a tremendous amount of distance.
And I guess that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Malta is not really a concern of mine.
Okay.
What is a concern of mine is all of your air force attacking the Saharan detachment. My ace in the hole. My guys who were going to slink on...
It's going to be a literal hole now.
They were going to go through enemy lines. They were going to be my truck bandits, except they were going to do real damage. But now, they're going to be pinned.
My truck bandits did real damage.
They're all going to be pinned. Half of them are going to be dead from strafes. I know for a fact they're not going to get a move next op stage.
No.
Yeah, of course. So that's annoying. It's delayed them. They'll have their store expenditure, they'll use up their water, and then they'll be killed.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm not best pleased about that, but that's it. You know, the dice giveth, the dice taketh away.
So, guys, quick check-in. We're going to do a more robust one next week, but just turn to yay or nay. How
definitely
are you feeling?
Despite the drawbacks of the weather and you having initiative... Massive yay.
Oh, yay for turn three, you.
Massive yay. Yeah. I am very big for turn three, very excited for it. Turn two went great.
Yeah, it did for you. You got your divisions, your sword, your supply stuff out.
Figured I had a lot more men than I realized. I've now got the hang of trucks. I feel like I've got the hang of the sort of logistical push and pull when it comes to moving my men and the little dance of combat. So I think overall, I am in a far better position than I was at the end of turn one. Not just because I am in a better position on the map, but I also think me as a player, I just understand the game so much better that going forward, I feel so much more confident.
Yeah, same actually. Position-wise on the map, I'm not feeling as good, but I think turn two went pretty well for me.
You aren't in like a dire situation, though. You've fallen back, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I think it sort of is necessary a bit.
By the nature of this scenario, you're outmanned massively. So yeah. Yours is more of a defensive play anyway. And you having your men start to galvanize around the likes of Mercer Matru, it feels like probably the right play.
Yeah,
I think I hope if I was so. In your shoes, I'd probably do the same thing. So I think we're kind of playing to our strengths now.
Yeah.
I'm going for the heavy push. You're starting to bolster the defendable points.
After sort of two turns of raiding.
Yeah, two turns of skirmish and two turns of...
Got in at Fort Magdalena, got your planes there. Truck Bandits got some planes. I'm pretty happy with the like harassment, as it were, before I fall back.
Fort Magdalena was our RuneScape tutorial island.
Yes.
That's where we got to learn the ropes of the game overall. We got to play around with the combat, close assault. We got to play around with capturing some prisoners, killing some SGSUs, taking out an airfield, doing some bombing runs, some close air combat, some close air protection. We did a lot of stuff around around Fort Magdalena.
It was sort of the turn two hotspot.
It was. Turn one saw it really come into its own. Turn two, we saw it out. And now we're going out into the big, wide-open desert. The deserts of our minds have broadened. And now here we are. It's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautiful. It's terrifying. And
it's actually exciting.
I'm looking forward
to playing more.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And you touched on it there. We will get into it a lot more next week. Because next week, is, it's a big episode. Next week's 50, and it's not only 50, but we will be recording on the anniversary of the day when we actually got the board game.
When the box arrived.
When the box arrived, when we held it in our hands for the first time. Next week, it will be a whole year since we started doing this, and we've just finished turn two. Do the maths.
It's not good.
No, it's 50 years at the moment. It's 60 years, realistically, to finish it. But we're picking up the pace. We've got the hang of it. We've learned the ropes. But that's in the rearview mirror. Turn two's gone. Turn three's ahead of us. Oh, and yeah. The only stopgap we have in between is going to be hearing what everyone has to say. Hearing what the listeners have sent in. Hearing what all you folks want to ask us or talk about.
Yeah, let's check it out.
So today we have a very lengthy, in-depth email from a repeat emailer, Arrow.
Yeah, Arrow, great listener, good email previously, and also just want to thank them at the start of this. In it, they offered in their previous email to give me a little help with some history stuff.
Yes.
And I took them up on that. So that'll be forming the basis of a couple of upcoming history segments, actually. So I'll highlight them when we get to them, but just want to start off saying a massive thanks to Arrow for putting some time and effort into helping me with some research. Really good stuff.
Yeah, not only did you send in this very detailed email, but there's a lot of back and forth where you provided some really incredible stuff, some recordings of some segments of history. Andy is very pleased with what he's got, so it's a real godsend. So thank you for that, Arrow. We've had a few people send stuff in, but I think yours might be the most detailed to date, which is astounding given some of the other stuff we've had. So, yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Shout out to Arrow, but yeah, let's jump into it.
Yeah, let's, because we've got a bit to get through. This might be the only email. I'd be surprised if it's not the only one today. Hello again. Just finished episode 43 today, but I have thoughts on episode 42's Common Ground about Zeppelins that I wanted to share and some other things. All right, well, I was against the Zeppelins here, so let's see how this goes. First off, some definitions. Zeppelins and blimps are two different things. Though they are very similar, the difference being Zeppelins are rigid. They have internal metal skeletons that support the balloon, which maintain its shape. Whereas a blimp does not have such an internal structure, making it more like an actual balloon. There are two major problems that led airships, I think that is.
It's a Led Zeppelin joke.
No, it's difficult because it's one of those words that's the same word both ways. The catch-all term for both Zeppelins and blimps. I guess, yeah, airships. We should start referring to them as airships. To entirely fall out of favour. You correctly identified one, the fact they're often filled with hydrogen. If I recall, they can also be filled with helium. But that would just sound funny if you're in them then. At least back in their day. There were either a hurdle to doing that, or helium is actually less effective than hydrogen for the job, and thus hydrogen is really required for the best performance. Now, helium isn't flammable, but hydrogen is so flammable that it was originally called inflammable air when it was discovered. Right, Andy, this is really vindicating for me to hear. Which, by the way, fun fact about the English language, flammable is a word invented fairly recently, 1813 in its first recorded use. The word was monetized... sorry, coughing. was after modernization saw the need to put up signs such as warning people about flammable substances. Inflammable is the older word, derived from the word inflame, which means the exact same thing as the modern word flammable, that doing something, that something easily catches. My words are fucking all over. I understand the gist of this, and I'm not communicating it very well, Arrow. Inflammable has the same meaning that flammable now has. Inflammable was the OG.
Yes.
I'm butchering your email. However, he continues, you might have already spotted the problem. In is a negating prefix that is common in English. And so this word caused widespread confusion on warning signs with many people, perhaps not unreasonably, thinking it was meant the substance was not flammable. Thus the in was dropped and the modern word flammable is still used in today, whereas inflammable is more confusing than ever and thus very rarely used.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like a good change because I could see that tripping people up in the situation you least want to be confused about.
Yeah,
the word for this will catch fire and the this is not going to catch fire should not be confusable.
Now, what's wild is, I don't know if it was you, Andy, that I had this conversation with recently, but I talked about this in the last couple of weeks. Was it you?
Yeah, I think after I read this, I mentioned it, because a friend of ours is doing a language course about how words change over time. So
yes, it's the mysterious man who actually introduced us to the game. It's that guy,
yeah,
the progenitor. So yes, I may have made things more confusing by having a coughing fit partway through and then misreading part of the email. But the gist of what Arrow's trying to educate us of is that inflammable was the original flammable, and they changed that because inflammable, it's confusing.
Yes.
So thank you for that, Arrow. That is very interesting when it's read coherently. He goes on. However, the other problem with airships is how easily they are pushed around by the wind. They're a bit like having a floating barn. They have absolutely massive surface for even the slightest winds to push against, and thus docking them or otherwise generally trying to keep them in one spot is an absolute pain. Good point. Andy, what's your rebuttal?
I think this is quite succinctly chopping that common ground down to size. I think Arrow's correctly pointing out a lot of issues.
Arrow, I knew I liked you. You're really helping keep this common ground where it belongs, in the air, on fire. To illustrate, I don't know if there's any British equivalent to the American Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which is a huge parade full of celebrity appearances, marching bands, impressive floats, and most notoriously and relevantly, large balloons of various cartoon characters. Real examples include SpongeBob, Sonic the Hedgehog, and fucking Boss Baby. See attached video. I've not actually seen the video yet. The parade is held on Thanksgiving Day and goes through the streets of New York City. Are you putting the video on there?
I clicked on it by mistake and started playing it, yes.
And even these videos, which are much smaller than blimps and very commonly pushed around by the wind in the narrow streets. And every other year, one or two snag on a lamppost or something and get punctured. Now, I have seen videos of it. I don't think there's anything like that in the UK.
I don't think so. That feels like a very American thing.
It is. I think it's sort of the quite flashy, everyone come together, big streets, big city, huge spectacle.
I feel like Brits don't really do parades.
No, the biggest thing that we have that I can think of, which at all evokes a similar feeling, is during COVID, we had a thing where everybody would come out their homes on a Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. and clap for the National Health Service, which is, for anyone not in the UK, the nationalised health service.
Very British, it's a weird social obligation to make an empty gesture.
Oh, I meant the NHS.
Oh, okay.
I guess it depends on your viewpoint of it, but yes, the NHS is our National Health Service. It's our hospitals. And for all of the workers, the key workers during the pandemic, we all came outside and we clapped and banged pots and pans. And it was kind of an empty gesture because they didn't actually get a pay increase on the back of COVID.
Yeah.
So that's the closest we had. I guess much sadder than something snagging on a lamppost, but it feels the same. It's deflating. Yeah. Back to airships, though. You've put it very brilliantly, Arrow. Since Zeppelins have a rigid structure, they cannot simply be deflated like a blimp can for storage. And so, unless one builds a truly monstrously large and equally hideous expensive hangar, they must be stored outside, free to be terrorized by the aforementioned mild breezes. That's a good point. Storage is a nightmare as well. Andy, over to you.
Oh, being terrorized by a mild breeze really underlines how bad of an idea that was. However, how much like how hydrogen is what you really want over helium, despite the downside, you need a Zeppelin for what you're proposing. That rigid structure is required for them to be large enough to have lift capacity to be of any real use. Blimps are comparatively small and only tend to have a cabin with enough room for a few people. We're talking about the equivalent of a sedan-style car to a Cessna plane. Too big without the rigidity and they would flop all over the place and become uncontrollable. In World War I, Zeppelins were able to act as bombers carrying payloads and actually bombing England. Not to mention that they did get used for civilian transportation in their time, even if it was limited. Meanwhile, blimps were only really used for aerial observation and scouting, and I've never been big enough for civilian transport. So an air cruise ship would need to be a harder to manage Zeppelin. It would be a constant pain to get an on and off. Would need very strict fire safety rules. There would probably have to be a ton of new legal safety regulations for all aspects of them. That in and on itself would probably be a nightmare. Airships are something that will probably always capture our imagination as a what if, but the fact that they are very much a technological dead end, unfortunately. However, as someone who greatly prefers air travels to boats, I would love to take a Zeppelin cruise.
You say that. I'm remembering now. I don't know. You've watched Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Do you remember in season two of the new Doctor Who with David Tennant, when he goes to the parallel universe where Pete Tyler's still alive, Rose Tyler's dad?
Oh, yeah.
And they've got Zeppelins everywhere.
Yeah.
And what else happens there?
Cybermen?
Damn right, the Cybermen.
Are they?
Because it's dystopian. It's a bad idea. It's what cruel and flashy businessmen do to have a sense of control. It's not actually logistically sound. It's a way for them to show boisterously. It's just been proven here, in Arrow's own words, that it's not really any sort of viable option for even civilian transport. So the proof is in the pudding. In both science fiction and this email, it's been proven that it's just not a good idea.
Wait, though.
Okay, go on.
Furthermore, in the interwar years, the US nearly built a fleet of Navy Zeppelins.
I'm not taking nearly as a point.
That could launch and retrieve small planes and possibly would have occupied an effective niche before new technologies overtook them. I'll link the video I learned them from. Navy Airships Were Insane by Mustard. I've given that a watch. They really were insane.
As in, like, bad ideas?
Kind of. They were essentially, there we go. They were trying to do a flying aircraft carrier, and then they made an aircraft carrier. It was also the case of, like, oh, cool, the planes have spotted something. We must now flee at, like, 2 miles an hour.
So the new technologies that took over that Arrow's mentioned...
Boats.
...are just boats.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you say that, Arrow, that you much prefer air travel over boats, but it would seem boats won, historically. Boats won the hearts and minds of the people.
No, air won with airplanes. It was just...
Where do you put them, though, Andy? Where are you putting these airplanes?
Sometimes on boats.
That's right. That's right. And where are you never putting them?
Zeppelins.
Damn fucking right. You're never putting them in aircraft carriers.
I feel like Arrow's really backed you up here. In a way, I'm not enjoying.
Yeah, he's come here with facts, loaded with them as well. This is like halfway through the email as well. I guess we'll see what else we can get through here, because I love the stuff. I love it when it's backing me up. On the topic of forgetting about half your units... Oh, right, hang on a minute. We've dropped the Zeppelin thing, now we're just pointing out my mistakes, I see. I feel like it has definitely happened at some point that a unit was ordered to a place behind the lines... And in the pre-computerized age, other things took away the focus of the general officers for long enough that they forgot about it until something finally reminded them, such as the unit eventually asking up the line if they were ever going to get new orders. I can also imagine some units trying to keep their heads low and hoping to be forgotten about so they didn't actually need to see some combat. In a general sense, I think it's fun to ponder possible diegetic explanations for the mistakes you guys make. In other words, how people also fucked these things up in the real world. Arrow, I appreciate this so much because I need to justify this to myself sometimes because I lost about half of my men just because I didn't remember to check on them. And I've had the inverse happen today with the Saharan detachment because for some reason, all of a sudden, the Allied forces, the Commonwealth, are acutely aware of the Saharan detachment and then come bad weather, they're going to decide to commit all of their air capacity to attacking just them. So it there is a reason for that. You're right. I think there is a diegetic proposition. I think it's the fact that we're two men. We are not huge swathes of red tape and bureaucracy. We're just two subtle, humble, and brave gentlemen who are trying to keep track of an entire campaign.
But I do like what we know about the Italian army, the reason of the... Yeah, we don't want to march on the English with, like, not proper weapons or uniforms. We're going to hide in cities. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
It does. I think it actually really makes my mistake, not a mistake, but if anything, I'm keeping to the verisimilitude of the campaign. Might be a slight audio break there. Andy, your smoke alarm just started going off.
Yep.
I think it was around the time I said the word verisimilitude, your smoke alarm just started blaring. Okay. Something doesn't really want... You know what else catches fire without warning?
What?
Zeppelins, Andy.
Damn it.
Fucking Zeppelins. Anyway, as you were saying, as a last thing, never forget that most war, from the oldest civilizations to the present day, from the perspective yeah, of the average soldier, is mostly doing fuck all. Trying to eat, drink, and sleep enough, and marching around a ton, only occasionally and randomly interspersed with intense experiences of combat.
Experience. I think it's just a typo.
Oh, sorry, I don't know if that was a word that I've... Sorry, Ara, that's not me critiquing what you've typed there. I'm just worried sometimes I don't know the words. I love learning new words. And in modern wars like World War II, combat can be relatively brief for an individual. One may never really get a good look at their enemy on the battlefield, potentially more often seeing fleeting shapes and muzzle flashes from the shades of cover, and more firing in the general direction of where the enemy might be, or probably is, than at real individual targets, and hoping to get hit by bullets whizzing by. Though, in other cases, the enemy can be quite uncomfortably close. Killing a man by shooting him from 200 yards away and killing a man by stabbing him to death are very different experiences, as I've heard from first-hand encounters. Also, if you ever want to see what a long-sustained gunfight can do to buildings, look up the Siege of Marowi, which happened in 2017, when an ISIS-affiliated Southeast Asian terrorist army took control of a city in the southern Philippines. Video games and movies will probably never be practically able to show what real bullets, tank rounds, and other ordnance can actually do to concrete and buildings. I've attached one such image from the aftermath of that siege.
It's crazy looking at these images of, like, just the level of destruction.
I imagine it's just torn up. I mean, I've seen there's some conflicts going on right now, and I've seen some pretty garish, jarring stuff.
Yeah.
And just the disparity between what a city was and what a city is, that kind of devastation is genuinely chilling.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's hard to distinguish whether that's like bombing, whether that's close quarters combat. Because a lot of what happens now, it's distance.
Yeah.
It's missiles. It's drones. But back then, it's a lot of close quarters stuff.
Yeah, I think Arrows chose this example because it's primarily, I guess from the email, it seems to be tanks and small arms rather than like drone strikes and stuff.
Yeah, well, it will be definitely around then. Well, Arrow, you finish up with, well, I got serious. But such is history. Levity in reframing things from words on a page to the reality on the ground is often required. But I think it's also a field that benefits from sometimes remembering the saying that if you're laughing, you aren't crying. So keep having fun, keep playing the game, and keep learning. See you in the deserts of our minds, Arrow. Arrow, it's actually surprisingly poignant. Did not expect it to be such a poignant end to that, especially when it started off talking about Zeppelins. You've kind of done an episode of ours in reverse, where you've talked about the silly common ground, and then you've brought us around to the somber nature of what's happening in reality. And it does reflect an important point.
Yeah, really great email. Thank you very much, Shara. And also thanking you again for that extra stuff you've done. We'll be mentioning it when it comes up, but really helpful.
We said it in the first episode that we're not experts in, well, history at all, let alone military history or the North African campaign. And we do make light of the situation as best we can, because we're just playing a board game.
Oh, yeah.
We aren't actually commenting on the history, apart from the fact we've now developed a full history segment. But there is this poignant sense of when we're playing this and the fact that there is now this history segment, that we do have people sending in all this really fascinating stuff, that there is this air of real serious stuff that kind of like bounces off the atmosphere of what we're doing. And it is interesting to find that balance between talking about something so important and so serious, and then the spin of it being we're playing a board game for a very long time. It's wild. But thank you for that, Arrow. And we're available for messages at our email address, which is info@warwithamate.co.uk. Our Instagram is @warwithamate. We take messages on there. And our website is warwithamate.co.uk.
Yes.
And the web form on there is a way to get in touch with us. We promise it works.
I keep testing it.
Anything you want to send over, if it's war-related, history-related, game-related, any kind of question, or if it's just some other non sequitur you want to send over, that is appropriate to read over something that is going out on the internet, then we'll probably read that. We'll read that. But we thank you, Arrow, and everyone else who sent in emails. We've still got a backlog to get back through. We had a little dip where we were looking down the barrel of not having something to read out, and we're safe for a while. And anything you send, we promise we will get to.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, you guys are sending in great stuff, so.
And stuff that inspires history segments, Andy.
It does.
And what better transition than what I've just done right now?
To a history segment.
Lay it on me, Andy.
Well, last week we did the Italian starting state for this, for the invasion of Egypt. So now we're going to flip it and do the British side.
Let's see where we're at.
Start with some quotes from Waverley. Waverley? Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's Waverley.
The beginning of any war by the British are always marked by improvidence, improvisation, and too often, alas, by impossibilities being asked of the troops. I think that's fair, considering.
Yeah, I'll give that.
Yeah. Just another interesting thing I found out about Waverley. This is a quote describing him. He was intellectually formidable, although he did not parade the fact. In 1938, he gave the Lees Knowles Lecture at Cambridge on generals and generalship. Rommel carried a copy of these lectures with him throughout the entire North Africa campaign.
Oh, a little fanboy.
Yeah. Or trying to get little hints of weaknesses from it. I'm not... might see if it was learning from it or trying to find problems in it, but...
Well, know your enemy. Yeah. Know your enemy.
So the first thing to keep in mind for the British is the scope of Waverley's command. He's in charge of East Africa. So he's also dealing with Sudan, which the Italians are threatening, danger from the south in Italian-occupied Ethiopia. He's also responsible for policing Palestine and watching Syria, which belonged to the Vichy French. So in total, while fighting this war, he's also responsible for 9 countries across 2 continents.
Wow.
So he's mentally spread pretty thin.
Sorry, that's reframed me when I was complaining about 2 guys dealing with the campaign for North Africa.
Yeah.
I guess this guy kind of had a bigger thing going on, so fair enough.
Yeah. So for the British supply stuff, the position of Italy makes it possible for them to close down the Mediterranean and force the Mediterranean fleet to rely on the Suez Canal, so they can't bring supplies through the Mediterranean from Britain. So they had to import all of their stuff, partially from the colonies, and partially they started stimulating like local production. But to give you a scale of the logistical challenge they're dealing with on the British side, once the Italians declared war from 1940 to 1943, merchant ships had to travel from Britain round the Cape of Good Hope, so the bottom of South Africa, and then up and round, which made Egypt as far as Australia and New Zealand.
Oh my God.
It's 12,000 miles, which will take a ship 6 to 7 weeks. So when you put in loading and unloading times, like an urgent request for supplies will take...
Months,
yeah.
Wow, I did not realize what the time frame was for ships.
Yeah.
If you're having to make that journey, that's insane.
Which is incredibly impressive that the British in the game, which also reflects real life to a certain extent, have a limited supplies at Alexandria and Cairo.
Yeah, it means
like they pull it off.
They've streamlined that process.
Yeah.
They have it down to a T.
when they were getting fighter planes, they'd fly them over Central Africa through a series of temporary airstrips they set up. So they were, yeah, they were flying their planes in across Africa. To give you the scale of it, when Italy was taken out of the war later on, it literally opened up 1 million tons of shipping a year.
Wow.
The Commonwealth fleet they have, which I have in the game, was anchored at Alexandria for most of the war between like heading out. Waverley saw this problem coming and invested in creating something called the Middle East Supply Center, which was created in April 1941 to promote agricultural efficiency and get people growing food like locally so they don't have to ship as much stuff in. And this really paid off. By March 1943, the supply center had replaced 100 cargo ships worth of food and supplies with excess oil, potatoes, dairy products, bringing cattle up from Sudan. So Waverley saw supply issues coming and took steps to locally produce the stuff.
And have you done that in the game?
I'm benefiting from it.
Well, have you made a farm?
No, not yet.
Well, there's no rules for farms, I guess.
No, Richard Berg missed that.
Maybe we need to add in farm rules when we're done with this. Get a bit of a Farmville thing going. That's a throwback to Facebook of 2008.
That is an old one. So in 1940, British forces had a base at the end of the Egyptian State Railway at the port of Mersa Matruh.
Yeah, heard of that one.
200 miles west of Alexandria. They began construction on a water pipeline along the railway and looked for water, but most of the wells they dug filled with salt water, which is a problem in this desert as well, especially in like the Qatar Depression and stuff, is it's salt. Like, if you filled it with water, it would be an inland like sea, because it used to be full of water and it evaporated off. So there's like immense amounts of salt there.
You know who's right next to the depression right now?
The Saharan Detachment.
The Saharan Detachment are right next door.
Yeah. I think we mentioned as well in the Libyan Sand series that there was a plan to fill that in by building like a tunnel between the Mediterranean. I might do a episode about that. It's not directly related, but it's a mad idea.
It's a kind of, it's a tertiary, ridiculous plan.
This is crazy to me. In 1939, the primary source of fresh water for Mersa Matruh was the Roman aqueducts.
Really?
Yeah, which still operational.
You know what?
Up to that point.
That does remind me of I went to Rome a few years ago, and we got a tour of the aqueducts underneath the Trevi Fountain and the area around there. And the guy spoke really good English. He was Italian, and everything he was saying just sort of flowed very perfectly. But then he would get to the word aqueducts, and it would just become this very peculiar pronounced word. Everything else sounded like it was part of a uniformed second language.
Yeah.
But then aqueducts would come out like aqueduke. And I was like, is there a way that he's learned that, or is there something about that word?
Must be, but
Everything else sounded like it was sort of like a spin, an accent on an English word. But then aqueduct, I don't know, maybe, because that doesn't sound like it's the Italian word for aqueduct. So I don't feel like...
I don't know, but yeah.
Because you know when someone replaces a word in one language with another and sort of like fills in, I don't know, that reminded me of that. I haven't heard the word aqueduct since I was in Rome, so... Sorry, continue.
Oh, yeah. I just think it's insane that, like, 2,000 years after they built it, it's being used.
Yeah, I mean, the layers of them as well. When I saw them in person, it's crazy how they look.
So, yeah, we'll get to the forces. So, the Western Desert Force, you got the 4th Indian Division.
I know them well.
Yep, known as the Red Eagle Division. It had 2 infantry brigades and some artillery. The 16th Infantry Brigade also got assigned to the 4th at the time, but would later join the 70th Infantry Division, who haven't arrived in the game yet. And then we have the 7th Armored Division, who we'll be picking back up with next week, but we know some of them so far. That's their mechanized division. trained for the desert.
The desert rats.
Yes. There's a garrison at Mirsa Matru, and then there's a smattering of other forces that aren't assigned to divisions. So you've got horse artillery, for instance, although they're not using horses anymore. They stopped doing that in 1939.
Ah, just before then.
Just before. Which is a good move, because dealing with horses in this conflict...
I'm so glad there's not horse rules in this game. Yeah.
And then we've also got the 2nd New Zealand Division, who are under strength, and they'll dip in and out of the conflict. They'll head to Crete and Syria later on. But at the start of the invasion, they have an infantry battalion and a few vehicles. And then we've also got the long-range desert group, which we talked about. Overall, that's 31,000 soldiers, 120 guns, and 275 tanks. Versus 250,000 men, twice that many tanks of the Italians. But the tanks they did have were better.
Yes.
For instance, the Mark VI light tanks, which I've got a lot of, is a three-man tank originally designed for reconnaissance and colonial warfare, not tank-to-tank fighting. But they get away with this because of the quality of the Italian tankettes.
They're essentially fighting men.
Yeah.
In metal suits.
So yeah, it's a three-man crew. There's room in there for a radio, so each tank has a radio for communicating with others, which is very important considering some Italian like divisions didn't have radios that worked.
Well, no, I think they had two cans with string between them.
Yeah. And a max speed of 35 miles an hour, so they're zipping around.
Wow, speedy boys.
Yeah. Its armor can stop rifle and machine guns, but not much more. And it's armed with two machine guns of its own. So primarily like an anti-infantry vehicle, but it can deal with the Italian tankettes. I also get the A9 or Cruiser 1 and the A10 Cruiser 2 tanks. Despite these having like sequential numbers, one is a light tank and one's a medium tank developed at the same time. So it's not like later versions, it's different versions of...
Okay, yeah.
More heavily armoured... they'd serve incredibly well against Italian tanks, but were outclassed by the Germans when they arrived. So despite the low numbers, the British, they're just better equipped. And they also train in the desert quite a lot at this point, whereas the Italians, as we mentioned, are mainly training in garrison, so they're not like ready for it when they go out into the desert. Main infantry weapon, the Lee Enfield rifle, accurate, reliable, sort of, has a reputation to this day as a mm-hmm. good rifle.
One I've heard of.
Yeah. So we'll get to my Air Force next. So I have, at the end of May 1940, so the conflict starts in September, but this is leading up to it, 205 aircraft in total, 96 bombers split between Bombay medium bombers, which are modified transport craft, so they're not built as dedicated bombers.
That's interesting.
And obsolete by the sort of around this time, they're going obsolete. Yeah, but I think they like literally took transport planes and cut like the bottom to so make could... panels to like drop bombs through.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so a bit of innovation going on there.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, way of innovation, improvising. Yeah. And then we've also got the Blenheim, which are more modern bombers that are replacing the sort of obsolete Bombay.
Yeah.
And then we'll get to the fighters. For fighters, primarily the Gladiator, which is a biplane, the last the RAF ever used before they're replaced by monoplanes. They're obsolete sort of at the start of this conflict. And I've got a nice little quote to describe them here.
Yeah.
Keep in mind the thing about inflammable and flammable, because it's using inflammable in this quote in the flammable sense.
Oh, Arrow, you've done us justice here. You're going to save any confusion here. Nicely. So invert this.
Yeah. Those old gladiators aren't made from stress steel like a hurricane or a spit. They have taut canvas wings covered with magnificently inflammable dope, and underneath there are hundreds of small thin sticks, the kind you put under logs for kindling, only these are drier and thinner. If a clever man said, I'm going to build a big thing that will burn better and quicker than anything else in the world, and if he applied himself diligently to the task, he would probably finish up building something very like a gladiator.
Oh, this guy is really ragging on them.
That guy is beloved author Roald Dahl.
What?
Who served as a pilot of gladiators in World War II in North Africa.
Really?
Yes. He had a pretty horrific crash near Mersa Matruh. That was the swelling on his brain was so bad he was blind for 6 weeks. He credits this crash for his creativity.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
I had no idea Roald Dahl served in North Africa or the war at all.
Yeah, he was a pilot until he crashed.
I've got my time scales completely off of Roald Dahl then.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because after that, he served as a like intelligence officer and diplomat.
Wow, I did not know any of this.
Might do a Roald Dahl episode.
God, we need to, where's the Roald Dahl episode?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool.
So, yeah, I've not gone too far into comparing the numbers I've researched with the numbers from the book yet, but they seem to be very close. I've not like broken it down properly, but they seem pretty spot on.
I mean, yeah, at a cursory glance from what you've described on both sides, the aircraft is, I think, the one where I see the most clear comparison.
Yeah.
That seems to be pretty spot on. Everything else, like the unit stuff, we talked about it previously. It's hard to gauge at the moment because we're not peering at each other's sheets.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it probably is pretty accurate.
Yeah, which is an impressive level of research pre-internet, so... Yeah, he's clearly gone deep on this. The claims of like all the research feel correct.
Yeah, Richard Berg was not hanging about when he did this. The guy went all in.
So this research has scared me a bit because it seems what allowed the British to hold off the Italians was better training and equipment, but also the quality of their commanders and leadership. The British benefited from the gap in quality between those two things, but I'm responsible for that, so I need to make up the gap. But yeah, I think we got the sort of massed quantity on one side, quality on the other, for the starting point, at least, of the two sides.
Well, you've done wonders to put this into context, because our situation does not give justice to any of the actual conflict, because we are doing things completely differently.
Yes.
The long-range desert group are ineffective. The 7th Armored Division are stuck and trapped. And for some reason, a few select infantry units are now truck bandits rushing off deep towards the Libyan deserts with no real rhyme or reason. And also, my air superiority has been completely hamstrung by the rain.
Yes.
So it all changes here at this table.
I need to... I'm going to make a note. I'm going to go find the historic weather things so we can compare.
I think that's... Yeah, that's a good point. We need to see how strongly our weather correlates with real life.
But yeah, that's it for the history segment. We'll be back on the 7th next week. But hopefully that gives us an idea of what we're starting with, at least.
And what we're starting with is... it's mismatched.
Yes.
It's all over the place. But what it is what we've got to deal with, and... What we have now is, well, we have a reckoning, Andy.
We need some common ground.
We need some common ground.
And now for something nicer. A little oasis in the war. It's time for some common ground. I'm trying the intro for common ground. I'm recording. Maybe.
Common Ground is an opportunity every week for you and I to find that space to become friends again. Because when we're at conflict for the next 25, 70 years, we need to be able to still hang out.
Yeah.
So, my topic this week, since we alternate, I've decided to try and find an opportunity for us to agree on something which I think is universal.
Oh, okay.
I think, as a collective society of humans, we need to find whatever anxiety-ridden magic they put into the big light, and we need to remove it.
Okay, you're going to need to walk me through something. What's the big light?
The big light.
The sun.
No, like in the living room. You know, like the big light that you put on.
Okay, yeah.
You know, in like a, in a, I guess, yeah, a living room and front room, you come in, you switch on the big light.
Okay, yes, I know what you mean now.
Yeah, you've got the big light and you've got like a lamp.
Yeah.
Every living room has the big light and they've got the lamp. The lamp is, we've got the lamp on right now. We're doing this by lamplight. We're not doing it under the big light. If you have the big light on, that means something's wrong.
Yeah, you're not hanging out, you're like cleaning or something.
Exactly. It's purpose driven. If you're in a a nightclub, the lights come on at the end, you know it's over.
Yeah. It's been over for a while.
The night's done.
Yes, get out.
If that isn't on, it's the fun atmospheric lights.
Okay, so you think the big lights cause anxiety?
I think there's something that they've put in them with magic that make people feel anxious.
Wow, okay.
So, are you telling me you don't feel anxious when the big light's on?
No, not particularly. I mean, you like to turn it off when both playing D&D and recording.
Tell you what, I'm going to do a quick experiment.
Okay. He is turning the big light on. Oh, it's too much.
Do you feel more or less anxious than before?
I do feel more anxious.
You feel more anxious right now?
I do, yeah.
This is less comfortable, isn't it?
Yes.
It feels like something is oppressing you. This doesn't feel comfortable, does it?
Yeah, it's because this light isn't warm, it's like clinical.
Exactly, the big light is clinical.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the warm tones of a normal light.
It's not magic, though.
So what is it?
It's...
Explain why this is happening right now, because I've just put the big light on in your living room.
Because that's like a white bulb, and that one's like warmer light.
Yeah, so what did they put in the white bulb that makes it scary?
I don't know, maybe it's up high. So your common ground is you want to get rid of the anxiety caused by the big light?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm happy to alternatives, because I think a big light, like you just said, it has practicality to it. It has utility. You're doing a clean. You're finding things. I don't know, you could be doing anything under the big light, but it's always business. It's always doing something.
Yeah, and then if you're like reading or something, you use the lamp.
Yeah, like only a mad person would do reading under this. There's no way under this lighting you would sit over there on that sofa, and if that celebrity, you know him?
Yeah.
If he moved away, first of all, why is he still here?
He hasn't left.
Yeah, well, I know he hasn't left. That's what I'm asking why.
He just lives here now.
Really? Does he pay anything towards this place?
No, he says because he's on the couch, he shouldn't have to.
That's not how that works.
I know, but I can't get rid of him. Yeah. He's too famous.
Yeah, that's it.
And powerful.
Does he not have something coming up? I'm sure I read in the news.
Oh, he's got like a film. He left from a premiere for a bit and then came back.
Is it the soundtrack he's doing for the film or is it? I can't remember. I don't know. Either way, it's kind of unprofessional. I guess maybe he's the anxiety instead of the big light. But I think with this big light situation... There's an alternative. I don't want to completely eradicate the big light.
I think we should be using lamps more for other things. Because I think the big light also reminds you of, like, work and being in an office.
Ooh, good point. Good point. I do associate it with that.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm asking for is for you to tell me what makes me anxious.
I think you associate it with, I don't know, hospitals and work and... Not relaxing.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't relax when the big light's on. It feels like a passive aggressive message.
I'd be up for more lamps and less big light.
Like I
save
guess,
big lights for corridors and stuff. And if it's a space you're going to spend a lot of time in,
here's a picture I'll paint you, and maybe this will delve more into the psychology behind it. So say. Say we're hanging out at my place, not yours.
Okay.
And we're doing what we did the other day. Me, you, and our pal, we sat around. We watched Halloween. We got round to it.
Yes, we watched Halloween, and it was good. And then we watched...
And then we watched War of the Worlds, and it was fucking horrible. Which is horrible.
Maybe the best, worst film I've seen in a long time.
If anyone has... It's on Amazon Prime, isn't it?
Yes.
If anyone has Amazon Prime, and they're listening to this, if you have the time anytime soon... Watch the film War of the Worlds with Ice Cube.
And friends.
Yeah, watch it with friends.
It's not a solo watch.
If you watch that on your own, you'll just have a bad few hours. If you watch it with friends, and they are also accepting of wasting their time, then you'll enjoy yourself. It is, I think, the worst film I've ever seen. And that's not me being hyperbolic. I genuinely think that is the worst film I've ever seen. It's so fucking bad that it's... It was nearly not funny.
Yeah.
It verged on the point of just making me really frustrated.
They just got under that line of it being just bad, though. Also, the funny thing about that is Ice Cube's character, that is such a bad guy.
They frame him as the protagonist, but everything he's doing is...
illegal and immoral.
I'd actually struggle to find anyone on any moral or political compass who sees him as the paradigm of being good.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. So say we're watching a film.
Yeah.
We're hanging out at my place. We've got a film on. And then afterwards, we're just sat, we're chilling, having a few beers, kicking back, relaxing. And then just partway through the conversation, I put the big light on.
I would be like, what's up? What are you looking for?
Yeah. You wouldn't just be... And if I was like, oh, sorry, I just wanted the lighting to be different.
Yeah, I'd be a bit suspect.
You wouldn't believe that, would you?
No.
Because the lighting speaks louder than my words. You would believe the light more than your trusted friend.
Yeah.
It holds more weight than my words.
It does, actually.
And if turning a light on holds more weight than my words, then that means something's wrong.
I don't think it's magic or anything.
Wow, but what else could it be?
I think there's some psychology to the big light that needs to be explored.
Yeah, but psychology comes from magic.
We don't have time for me to disagree with you on this.
I guess what's your workaround then?
For the big light problem.
I guess for both what I've just said and the big light problem. Encapsulate it into one.
I'm going to ignore the magic psychology thing. I'm just going to ignore it. And the solution is more lamps.
More lamps where though? Because what about when someone turns on the big light?
Well, that's about like the social contract.
Well, maybe that's what it is. We need to get the awareness out that you don't put the big light on.
Because we, weirdly enough, we have it on when we're playing the game.
Well, yeah, because that is a clinical job. That is something that requires inspection and finesse. It's not about enjoying yourself. It's not about having a calm time. We're looking at small pieces of cardboard on a 10-foot-long board. It's an important thing to get accurate and get right. Relaxing and having fun shouldn't be accurate and right.
I feel like it's a good demarcator, though. Big lights on, I've got stuff to do. Oh, it's off for the night.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I am fine with that. It's as long as we understand and respect that it does have this power.
Oh, yeah. I
guess maybe that's part of it as well. I'd be more comfortable if people used this power responsibly. If they have it on willy-nilly, I'm scared. I'm anxious. If they use it with decorum, if they're measured with their application of the big light, I won't be as worried.
Okay.
If you put the big light on, I know something's wrong. If you keep the big light off, we're gonna have a fun time.
Weird mantra, but okay. Okay, we've got a common ground here. The big light is oppressive and work-focused.
It is. And if that is the common ground, then that works for me.
I might take the big light out of my bedroom.
Like, get rid of it?
Yeah.
Just have lamps?
Yeah.
You definitely should in your bedroom, man.
I mean, I have lamps, but I might just remove the option.
Completely?
Yeah.
Take out the wiring.
This is a space for relaxation. I'm going to remove it and plaster over the hole.
Yeah, I would recommend that. Or, tell you what, dimmer switch.
That's a good option, but I'm just paying a contractor to remove all of the big lights from my house and, like, plaster over the ceiling, and then my landlord comes when I move out, and I'm just like, there was never big lights. Just gaslighting him.
Just get a dimmer switch. That works perfectly. Do you remember I had a dimmer switch? You know the place I lived at before we got a place
together?
Yeah,
you had one of those magic light bulbs that changed, not magic. We keep associating light bulbs with magic. You had one of those multicolored light bulbs.
No, no, I mean my place way back when I lived on my own. That was a dimmer switch.
Was that the one we started playing D&D in?
It was, yes. Yeah. I had a dimmer switch for that.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Me too, until this conversation. I forgot about that for about 4 years, and I've only just remembered it now. Oh, I miss that dimmer switch.
They're not very common here.
They're not. That's why it was such a good find. Yeah. I might move back in there.
Bring them back.
Bring back the dimmer switch.
Or introduce them.
The dimmer switch. That's the solution.
We found it.
The common ground, that's it. It's all about... There's no black and white with common ground. It's about just turning that dial until you find that lighting that just makes everything perfect. The
obscures
obscures the bad. And with our obscured imperfections, with our longevity of torture, but our enjoyment of it, I guess that's all there is to say.
That's it.
You know where to find us. Our email address is info@warwithamate.co.uk. Our Instagram is warwithamate, and our website is warwithamate.co.uk. It's basically warwithamate with things taken or added to the back or end.
And there'll be a Movember link in this episode description if you want him, James, to post a picture of his mustache, or you want to get a couple of guys together, maybe do your own fundraiser to get a grand, donate that so he gets a tattoo. We'd all enjoy that.
I don't know about that. But
maybe crowdfund you something.
It's a, you know what, it's a great cause. So however you want to get money into that, I encourage it. And we'll say 100 pounds, the sort of base goal. I'll show you guys my bad mustache. If you get it 1,000, fuck it, I'll get a War with a Mate tattoo. I don't know what I'll get.
The start and end now.
I don't know. Oh my God, I'm so scared of tattoos. I'm so scared of getting a tattoo. But if it happens, I guess. It's for a good cause. It's just scary to think about. But it's a really good cause. It's fine. This is for a good thing. And whatever you do, whoever you're friends with, do not be alone out there in the deserts of your mind. Make sure you talk with your friends. Make sure you look out for each other. And apart from that, make sure you tune in next week. It's the big anniversary.
It's going to be a big one. So until then, stay subtle, humble, and brave.
And you'll hear from us then. Fare thee well.